Let me say some words about the IMF's lending mechanisms, and in particular address a very hot topic these days, the question of IMF governance. One criticism often directed at the fund has been that it does not provide resources in a way that effectively restores confidence. From the moment that it becomes clear that the country will need additional funding because it is facing a liquidity crisis, to the time that the money is made available, several months may have passed, and valuable time during which the underlying causes of the crisis may have deteriorated further, undermining even more investor sentiment. These delays are largely dictated by the demands of IMF conditionality, you know, the tedious and lengthy process of negotiating loan conditions while the house is effectively on fire. Now, this feature of IMF operations is well known. In a nutshell, traditionally the IMF has not lent freely in the midst of a crisis to a country that may be illiquid but otherwise solvent. Rather, it disburses funds in tranches as the country meets a variety of performance criteria. Now, since these conditions may be quite onerous and take many months to implement, it will typically not be clear to the market whether the resources committed will actually be disbursed. And this undermines, of course, confidence and makes the country vulnerable to speculative attacks. In contrast, if you think about it, a well-developed central bank facing a liquidity crisis in the financial system can typically respond in a manner of hours, as it understands that it must shape and manage expectations, and as we have seen many times during the past 12 months, in 2008 and 2009 in particular. Partly in response to this criticism, the IMF created a special quick disbursing facility called the Emergency Financing Procedure, but it has been used only twice this decade, by Turkey in 2001 and by Georgia in 2008. In any case, it's clear that giving the fund the potential access to a much larger volume of resources, as has been decided at the London summit of the G20 in April of 2009, would have to be accompanied by significant internal reforms, both in terms of the content of the policies that it advocates, as well as its internal management. Let me say a bit on both. In terms of the content of policy prescriptions, what we have said so far says nothing about the kinds of policies which the IMF advocates and whether these are generally welfare enhancing or not. IMF involvement in past crises has generated heated debates as to whether the IMF is part of the problem, part of the solution, or maybe at times a bit of both. It seems to me, however, that if the fund is to be given more of the functions of a lender of last resort, particularly for countries in the emerging market world, then it needs to modernize its philosophy, bringing into the center of its conditionality the kinds of concerns and policies which so far it has only tended to espouse in theory. In their speeches, the fund's managers speak of transparency, social protection, good governance, and high quality growth. But they have not yet managed to incorporate these very laudable aims into IMF program design. Indeed, most IMF programs yield distressingly disappointing results. Not surprisingly, the fund itself finds itself often blamed for the failure of its policy prescriptions. This in turn undermines its credibility and prevents those who recognize the importance of the organization in today's globalized financial markets from endorsing proposals aimed at enhancing its influence. The above would need to be accompanied, of course, by a structural reorganization whereby the fund's shareholders assign to it a greater measure of intellectual independence, making it at the same time more accountable for the consequences of its decisions. It would seem desirable, for instance, to separate the fund's surveilling activities from its decisions in respect of lending so that glaring conflicts of interest might be avoided. The emphasis in recent years on the implementation of code standards for fiscal, monetary, and other policies to diminish the likelihood of future crises is certainly a step in the right direction. Surely the focus should overwhelmingly shift to crisis prevention rather than crisis resolution. The fund, of course, has a problem in terms of the asymmetry of its policy advice. By this we mean that it has leverage in those countries in which there are lending programs. And unfortunately, is often not paid any attention in the context of larger countries that have traditionally had access to world financial markets and have thus not needed to access the IMF purse strings. In the current crisis, I would expect that as credit rating agencies downgrade more and more nations, for many countries, IMF borrowing will become increasingly attractive, as it has already been in countries like Turkey, Hungary, Ukraine, Iceland, and many others, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. But even an updated set of policy prescriptions is unlikely to suffice without corresponding reforms in the internal workings of the organization. And this is where I would like to say a few words about governance. There are several dimensions to this issue. First, the voting power of its member countries needs to be updated and made to reflect the major changes which have taken place in the structure of the global economy during the past quarter century. It is simply absurd that the voting power of the European Union should stand at 32.4%, whereas the combined voting power of the United States, China, India, Brazil, and Russia comes to 26.9%. Though collectively, these countries account for a much larger share of global GDP, including, by the way, close to 50% of the world's population. This distribution of power leads to such anomalies as Belgium having a larger quota than India, and China having a quota only marginally higher than Italy's and well below that of France. Not surprisingly, Asian countries do not see that they have a stake in empowering the IMF, regarding it increasingly as embodying power relationships which no longer reflect contemporary realities. Indeed, to add insult to injury, against the background of the current global credit crunch, surplus countries like China are being asked to recycle some of their ample reserves through the IMF to other emerging markets in crisis, clearly a third best approach to boosting the institution's liquidity and counter to its multilateral character. An IMF without credibility is of no use to the international community, particularly at a time of world engulfing crisis. Welcome at the London summit of the G20 was the decision to finally break, at least nominally, with the convention adhered to ever since the IMF was created, which establishes that its managing director must be a European Union citizen. I'm sure many of you know, a similar practice applies to the World Bank, whose president has traditionally been an American citizen. Like the current permanent membership in the UN Security Council, this practice is an aberration and should have been abandoned long ago. It is, in fact, surprising that this practice has persisted for so long, given that whereas IMF lending operations have no budgetary implications for members such as the United States and the European Union, indeed, they actually earn a return on their SDR reserve assets. The salaries of the fund's managing director and of its entire staff, as well as other administrative expenditures, are entirely financed by the interest paid by borrowing countries. In other words, the IMF functions thanks to taxpayers in middle and low income countries, not the rich countries who have run it since it was first funded in the mid-1940s. Despite the important symbolism of the G20 decision in April of 2009, it seems to me that the new system is not likely to work much better, and there is a significant risk that it might actually be worse. The main risk is that we will now move to a system in place at the UN, where the Secretary General is chosen de facto on a rotating basis from different regions of the world. The problem with that system is that it tends towards the lowest acceptable common denominator, with the top job going to someone who's palatable to all constituencies, a process which, at the UN anyway, on occasion can lead to mediocrity or worse. Furthermore, merely allowing the managing director of the IMF to be chosen from a country other than in the European Union does not address a key flaw of the present system, namely the conflict of interest that may arise between those who hold the managing director's reappointment in their hands and the interests of the countries which it is his mission to serve.